Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro-Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gray.
There was a letter John Adams wrote, I believe, to his wife. They were separated for one reason or another, and they wrote to each other very faithfully. I think it was to his wife. It might have been to Thomas Jefferson, with whom Adams had a lively correspondence and a rather turbulent friendship that was at times less than amicable. But what he said, in essence, is that he studied the arts of politics and war so that his children would be able to study geography and mathematics and literature, and that he hoped his children would study geography and mathematics and literature so his grandchildren could study the fine arts. He had this idea that he was devoting himself to politics in the hope of creating a world in which politics would not loom over life quite so dramatically, in which politics would be consigned to a realm that was much more limited, that it wouldn't be all-encompassing, all-pervasive. He longed for an era that sort of transcended politics, and I was given cause to reflect somewhat in a melancholy way over the way my life could be if the state ruling us were not so aggressively vicious and usurient, implacably demanding our wealth and stealing and pilfering our liberties. You know, if we lived in a country that was genuinely civilized, the things I could do with my life. The reason why I was provoked into that somewhat winsome reverie was the arrival yesterday of a present from a good friend of mine in Wisconsin. Before we left Wisconsin 5 years ago, my friend, who is a guitar player, was commenting that he wished he had a guitar, and we didn't have the means to bring my guitar with me, my electric guitar, my Gibson Art, not Gibson, I only wish I had a Gibson, my Ibanez RG, lovely piece of musical machinery. It's purple and finished, and it's equipped with a Floyd Rose tremolo, and it's got Ibanez proprietary, I think they're V7 pickups that are almost as good as DiMarzio's. And I picked it up for about $4 back when I was playing in a weekend band in Wisconsin. And so with more than a little bit of remorse, I decided to let my friend have this guitar because we didn't have room for it in the minivan we were driving from Wisconsin to Idaho. We packed up what we could take in a minivan and made the pilgrimage west to Idaho. Well, over the course of the last couple of months, my friend contacted me and said that if I wanted, he'd return the guitar to me. And he'd always assumed that I was lending it to him rather than letting him have it. And so in spite of the fact that it made me feel like the proverbial Indian giver, I took him up on that offer. And so yesterday, we received a large package that contained, within a hard shell case, the fully strung and ready-to-play Ibanez RG that I thought I'd never see again 5 years ago. I plugged it into my little Roland Minicube amplifier and started to play, and found myself once again wishing that things had turned out a little bit differently, that I had zagged rather than zigging, and that I had stayed in my former profession as a musician, because it is so much fun to make music. What a wonderful way to spend one's time, and if only we had an economy in which it would be possible for me to make a living doing what I had felt a calling to do as a young man. My oldest son, William, is feeling the same sense of vocation. He's becoming an obsessive about the sixth string, as I was when I was just a little older than he. He's 12. He turns 13 in a couple of months. I didn't really start playing until I was about 14 years old. He's already made, quite frankly, terrifying progress in the last year and a half or so. A little less than a year, actually, since I got him an electric guitar for Christmas last year. But those are the things that I would like to do with my time. There are all kinds of wonderful, ennobling pursuits that have nothing to do with politics. And instead, I find myself, by way of conscience, immersed in the unpleasantness of government's all-encompassing full-spectrum assault on liberty and civility and everything that makes life worthwhile. And one really good example of that is what the FBI was up to over the last couple of days. This is from antiwar.com. Jason Ditz, their chief correspondent, FBI launching mass raids of anti-war activists' homes. INSIS raids are related to material support for terrorism. The FBI is confirming that this morning, that is yesterday, they began a number of raids against the homes of anti-war activists, claiming that they are seeking evidence relating to activities concerning the material support of terrorism. Boy, if you could qualify that any more, it would be qualifying the cause of those raids out of existence. Evidence relating to activities concerning the material support of terrorism. So there are basically 3 degrees of separation there, rhetorically, between the supposed evidence and the supposed defense of terrorism. So far, there do not appear to have been any arrests related to the raids, nor, according to FBI spokesman Steve Warfield, are there any expected. He also insisted that there was no imminent threat related to the anti-war organization targeted. Some of the activists say they were ordered to appear before a grand jury, however. As I pointed out, just at the end of the last hour, which, by the way, is up at libertynewsradio.com if you want to listen to the archives, as I pointed out, they used a SWAT team to beat down the door of a home. I believe it was a home above the Hard Luck Cafe in southern Minneapolis. This home was occupied by a woman and a six or seven-year-old child. When she couldn't see the search warrant through the peephole, they beat down the door, they destroyed a fish tank, and they went rifled through everything in the home in search of, well, nothing in particular. They were trawling for something that they could use, presumably, to connect the person whose home that was, a fellow by the name of Michael Kelly, or Mick Kelly, with this terrorism investigation. But if there's no imminent threat to the community and no arrests are contemplated, why send in a SWAT team? Well, they sent in a SWAT team because this is an act of state terrorism. The warrant against anti-war activist Mick Kelly's home cited efforts to look into his ability to pay for his own travel to Palestine and Colombia and appeared to have been little more than a fishing expedition looking for possible links to, quote, foreign terrorist organizations, including but not limited to FARC, F-A-R-C, that's the narco-terrorist group in Colombia, ELP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and Hezbollah. Kelly insists that the raids were about harassing anti-war organizers. Officials said they are related to a joint terrorism task force investigation. The JTTF in Minneapolis has a long history of heavy-handed investigations against protest groups, including an attempt in 2008 to infiltrate a vegan potluck. Oh, those turbulent vegans. Now, we're not talking about people who would be inhabitants of a star, of a planet orbiting the star Vega. We're talking about people who assiduously refuse to consume animal products. And quite frankly, a vegan potluck strikes me as a very nice way to spend an evening. Presumably it occurred at an evening. I'd like to attend a vegan potluck sometime. I bet it'd be delicious. Most of the raids were conducted in Minneapolis and were related to anti-war leaders in that city. Other raids were also reported in Chicago, in Michigan, and in North Carolina. Many of the homes targeted in Minneapolis were related to the Marxist-Leninist group Freedom Road Socialist Organization, FRSO, but this was not the only group targeted. Incidentally, the FRSO strikes me as almost a caricature of 60s vintage campus Stalinist leftism. So they make a very attractive target for this kind of raid because they're not a sympathetic target. I'll talk about this on the other side of the break. Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. Back at you in a minute. It's not that difficult to caricature a group like the Freedom Road Socialist Organization. After all, here's a group that actually, in its literature, took the side of the Chinese government against the Tiananmen Square protesters back in 1989 because they saw the Tiananmen Square protesters as counter-revolutionaries. And, of course, they weren't counter-revolutionaries. They're actual revolutionaries. But from the Stalinist perspective, somebody who wages a revolution against the triumphant forces of the proletariat is a counter-revolutionary That's the bad kind of revolution, according to the Stalinist dogma, which the FRSO, Freedom Road Socialist Organization, espouses. And so really the marquee subject of these raids that have taken place over the last couple of days in a number of states, Minnesota, Illinois, Michigan, apparently North Carolina as well, the marquee organization, the marquee figure is somebody who is a credentialed radical leftist of long standing. And that's the sort of a person they need as the synecdoche, if you will, of this so-called internal enemy. He's somebody who embodies, he's the living symbol of this supposed insurgent left-wing movement. And never mind, this is taking place under the reign of a president who's a former, quote-unquote, community organizer himself. You know, Barack Obama, back in 2001, when he was a glib and superficially charming but not particularly promising state senator in Illinois, gave a rather remarkable radio interview in which he talked about the failure of the Civil Rights Revolution, that it relied too heavily on the courts and seeking litigation as a way of changing the social structure without building the coalitions of power necessary to bring about redistributive change. And that's some pretty hardcore Marxist diction there. When he talks about redistributive change, of course, he's talking about using the power of the government to accomplish what he described as spreading the wealth around, meaning taking from the productive and giving to the parasitical. And that basically is Obamanomics in a nutshell. It's a slightly different flavor of corporatist collectivism from the one that existed until January 20th of 2009. Under George W. Bush, you had a different flavor of collectivist corporatism. They're all equally unpalatable to somebody like myself, whose moral taste buds are attuned to freedom. But the point is that Barack Obama would have to be considered a credentialed leftist as well. And it is under Barack Obama that the FBI is now going after people like the so-called Freedom Road Socialist Organization. Why? Because it's easy to make a case that these people who are comfortable in the company of bearded and malodorous revolutionaries are a threat to American society. But they're not really a threat to American society. They're marginalized and, as far as I can tell, completely impotent. They're posers. To the extent that they have any influence, any material influence, it's in the realm of agitating for policies that I happen to think are probably pretty good and pretty sound. They want an end to the occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq. I do as well. They want an end to what's going on in Colombia, where the United States government is promoting the war, so-called war on drugs, that's bringing about a civil war, a horrible civil war in that country. The same thing is true in Mexico. That's a policy with which I am sympathetic. They think that our policy with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian dispute is bad for both sides in that dispute. I happen to agree with that as well. What's happening is that there's an effort here, I think, to criminalize dissent. And that's the same kind of thing that happened under the Brezhnev-era Soviet Union. And I think that that is a very ominous development. We're joined now by Denny from Independence. I believe Independence, Missouri, correct? Are
no,
you there?
It's Independence, Oregon, a little to Independence, the west Oregon. Or the sunset.
Ah!
You know?
Okay, yeah. Forgive me. I'm sorry to have misplaced you. Welcome
to the
program.
Other end of other end of the Oregon Trail, you know.
Well, that's cool. We're at one end of the Oregon Trail here in the Treasure Valley, so
yeah,
welcome to the program, Denny.
Well, thank you very much. I've been listening to you. I never miss your show, but I listen on the podcast if I finally you know, remember to catch you live here Saturday night so I could call you and give you another.
I'm glad you did.
Another caller. I've been following you for years when you're writing for New American and all that, and really appreciate it. Every time I hear you or read you, I learn something new. So it's been
great.
That
means a lot to me. Thank you so much.
I appreciate you. Yeah. Hey, I've kind of watched. I wonder if my perception is correct. I've been, over the years, I perceive a movement more and more libertarian and maybe even more, free market anarchy in your political philosophy here.
I think that's a fair characterization, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I thought so. I've been moving that way myself. I finally got there. I'm kind of slow, but I finally realized that all government is coercion and violence and force and all.
Yeah, I've just had a surfeit of coercion and violence. That's exactly what led me to my current understanding of how the world works and how it should work. I just have a thoroughgoing aversion to the idea that somebody has the right and the authority to compel another person to act in a certain way. And yes, if you want a one-sentence description of my political ideology, could sum it up in one phrase: I can't stand bullies.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's, period. Full stop.
Well, yeah. Well, it just comes down to, you know, who owns you. You know, if someone else can tell you what to do, can take your property, you know, whatever. I mean, you don't own you; they own you.
Exactly.
You know, I got into this thing through the, you know, the anti-tax or the tax freedom movement, whatever. And, you know, I realized that all taxation was just theft. I mean, they use
a euphemism of
taxation, but it's just armed robbery, extortion, whatever you want to call it. You know, so
I disagree.
And I finally put the, you know, two and two together and realized that, well, that's what government is based on. I mean, it has to tax in order to exist, doesn't it? I mean, can you think of any way that a government could exist without, you know, taking money from somebody?
If you have a very small polity where people can have face-to-face conversations and agree on joint action that doesn't involve the compelled provision of a salary or material emoluments to somebody who's a representative, you can have a government on a very local level that wouldn't be coercive. And ideally, you'd have an extended league of governments that act that way that don't involve the forcible transfer of wealth from one person to another. And in discussing this, of course, we're very much within a theoretical realm. Aristophanes would refer to as cloud cuckoo land. It doesn't exist, unfortunately.
We're not going to see it in our lifetimes, I know, but you know, I think it's important to hold that as our ideal so that we can move towards that. You know,
exactly.
You don't know what direction to go, you'll never get where you want to be.
That's a very good way of putting it, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate all your hard work in moving people that direction. I hope that, you know, maybe the number of callers to your program is something like 1 out of 1,000.
Well, one of a city, two of a family, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. And I just hope more people discover your show. It's great.
Thank you so much.
Always good. Oh, by the way, I don't know why it's only been recently, but I just recently discovered the Voluntarist website.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that?
Voluntarist.com? I'm familiar with. Yeah, I think it's very worthwhile. Sure.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty good summary of my philosophy, I suppose, in the term voluntarism.
Yeah, well, I had not heard that term, even though it's been around for a long time. I hadn't heard that term until recently. It's a lot friendlier, more friendly sounding than anarchy, you know.
Exactly. Well, Denny, thanks so much for calling. God bless you.
Well,
I really appreciate the call. You take care. That was Denny from Independence, Oregon. Not Independence, Missouri, as I mistakenly said. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. Sure appreciate Denny joining me this evening. I'd like to hear from you. We'll be back in just a minute. Once again, I refer to the TV movie, the HBO film Sokurov from, I think, 1984, 1985. I'm trying to, it was Jason Robards, and I can't remember who played Yelena Bonner in that film. That Andrei Sokurov, was a physicist and a dissident. He was a political dissident during the 1960s and 1970s in the Brezhnevera Soviet Union. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. He may be one of the few people who received that prize who was not promoting aggressive revolutionary communism. He was a member of the Communist Party. He was a socialist by conviction, but he was a critic of the foreign policy of the Soviet regime. He believed that it was possible to bring about the socialist goals of the regime in ways that didn't involve the expansion through military force of the political control exercised by Moscow. I think he was wrong in that estimation, but I do admire the fact that he displayed no small amount of personal courage in defending the rights of people who were considered to be enemies of the state. The Brezhnev-era Soviet Union, for those who don't know or appreciate this fact, pioneered the use of psychiatry as an instrument of state policy. This is actually something which the Soviets started way back in the 1920s, and their allies here in the West have been very eagerly and very energetically pursuing the same types of policies that were somewhat salient during the Brezhnev era, the creation of what was called psychuska, which was the psychiatric gulag. People would be committed to the care of the psychiatric gulag for offenses against the state when they were deemed under, I believe it was Section 85 of the Soviet Penal Code, as enemies of the state. They were pursuing anti-Soviet agitation and propaganda. They could be summarily confined as psychologically unstable, because only somebody who was psychologically infirm would be so antisocial as to dispute the value of the triumph of the proletariat as embodied in the elite, the vanguard of the Soviet Communist Party. Vladimir Bukovsky wrote a book called To Build a Castle that described his experiences in the Soviet psychiatric gulag. He's one of my heroes. He stands about 6'7" tall. He's got a wicked sense of humor. Every Russian I've ever met, by the way, has a wicked sense of humor. One of the things that I read in his memoir that really made a lasting impression on me was that the KGB agents who hauled him away to the psychiatric gulag, where lobotomy was a very realistic possibility, as they slapped handcuffs on his wrists, one of the arresting officers from the KGB commented that the handcuffs had been made in the United States. That's the sort of thing that sticks with somebody. I read that when I was in high school or college. I can't remember which. That was one of the pieces of literature that left an indelible impression on my young mind and probably helped turn me into the torqued and socially unsuitable individual that I become as an adult. In any case, in this HBO movie, there's a scene where the KGB is conducting a midnight raid against the Sakharov residents. Actually, forgive me, it wasn't the Sakharov residents. One of the other members of their little dissident group. They were involved in what was called samizdat. Samizdat refers to the non-officially sanctioned circulation of literature. There were a lot of dissident publications that circulated in the underground as samizdat. One of the Sakharov's associates was working on behalf of somebody who was going to be sentenced to death for treason, that is to say, for working against the interests of the Soviet Communist Party. He wasn't working in collaboration with a foreign enemy. He wasn't trying to bring about an invasion that would overthrow the existing political order. He was simply working within what he understood to be his rights, such as they were, under the Soviet Constitution, and he was convicted of treason. One of his associates had smuggled his writings out of jail. And so the KGB showed up one night at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and they started rifling through the apartment of this dissident. And that's how Sakharov met Yelena Bonner. They met at a friend's house while the secret police was going through every book, every file, every document in this house, looking for something they could use to justify bringing this individual up for trial before a Soviet tribunal on political charges, usually having to do with terrorism or espionage. And yes, the term terrorism was used to describe dissidents in the Soviet Union, just as it's being used now to describe dissidents in the United States. Witness what just happened yesterday. And what's going on right now in four states is the FBI targets anti-war activists of an admittedly unsavory political persuasion. I don't have any brief for the ideology of the so-called Freedom Road Socialist Organization. I suspect that the entire membership of the FRSO could fit comfortably within the small room I use as an office here in my home in Payette, Idaho. I don't think that this is exactly a huge and ever-expanding army. We're not talking about the implacable, ever-expanding population of myrmidons of the International Socialist Movement. We're talking about a group of aging anti-war activists, for the most part, who have done nothing to harm anybody. But they have professed to be in solidarity with groups they consider to represent the oppressed masses of the world. And their selection of allies, I think, is dismal. I don't really think there's anything commendable about the FARC in Colombia, for instance. I think the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine isn't interested in liberating Palestine. I think they're interested in pretty much thrusting themselves at the top of a government that would enhance and further immiserate, enhance the suffering of and further immiserate the long-suffering Palestinians. I don't think they're a commendable group either. If they have anything to do with Hezbollah, I think they've miscalculated as well, although Hezbollah is considered a legitimate political party in Lebanon. But this guy, Mike Kelly, is a political dissident. He's somebody who's attached to the anti-war movement. He organized protest rallies at the Republican convention in 2008. That almost certainly is why he was targeted for a SWAT raid yesterday in order to seize what? Why were they sending in a SWAT team? Why were they sending in a SWAT team? Were they after the components of a weapon of mass destruction? No. Were they looking for drugs? No. Although I'm sure they would have been delighted if they could have found some. They sent in a SWAT team to intimidate the guy. I have in my hands, right here, forgive me for stealing that familiar riff, a document issued by the United States District Court describing itself as a search and seizure warrant in the matter of the search of the residence of Michael Kelly, located at a certain avenue and a certain apartment in Minneapolis. List of items to be seized. 1. Documents, files, books, photographs, videos, souvenirs, war relics, notebooks, address books, diaries, journals, maps, or other evidence, including evidence in electronic form related to A. Kelly's travel to and from and presence and activities in Minnesota and other foreign countries to which Kelly has traveled as part of his work in the FRSO. By the way, this is dismally written and even more shoddily edited. This is the work of somebody who was not paying attention to what he or she was writing. Kelly's ability to pay for his own travel from the United States to Palestine, Colombia, and travel within the United States from 2000 until the present, including all materials related to Kelly's personal finances and finances of the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, or FRSO. That's the first clause. The second, Kelly's potential co-conspirators. Stop right there. Co-conspirators in what? You have an unsupported allegation that's basically a soap bubble of innuendo, not connected to any predicate offense here. What's the offense? Co-conspirators in what sense? You can only be conspiring, in the legal sense, if you are joining in secretive league with somebody to accomplish an end that is forbidden by law or that is injurious to the legitimate rights of another. So far, we don't have a list of a supposed offense, but they're already imputing possible conspiracy to this guy. Kelly's potential co-conspirators, including any address books, lists, notes, photographs, videos, or letters of Kelly's personal contacts in the United States and abroad. Here's the third clause. By the way, these are listed alphabetically. The alphabet used by the FBI goes A, C, D, E. You notice something missing? There's no B here. Good enough for government work. They can't even recite the alphabet. Clause D, which is the third clause in the FBI special alphabet, the recruitment, indoctrination, and facilitation of other individuals in the United States to join FRSO, including materials related to the identity and location of recruiters, facilitators, and recruits, the means by which the recruits were recruited to join FRSO, the means by which the recruitment was financed and arranged. So far as I'm aware, the FRSO is a legal organization. It's not been proven to be involved in any kind of criminal activity so far. What they're doing is they're trying to criminalize, apparently, efforts to recruit people into this admittedly unsavory organization, unsavory in an ideological sense, and membership in said organization, so far as we can tell on the basis of this warrant. There are three more clauses in this ridiculously inept and presumptuous artifact that I'll share with you on the other side of the break. This is Will Grigg with Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. Stand by for more sedition after this.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Graves.
So what do you call it when the FBI raids somebody who's not accused of a crime and then acts on a search warrant that gives them the supposed authority to take just about anything they want out of a home without specifying why they're looking for it or the nature of the investigation? They use a SWAT team to carry out this raid in spite of the fact that they admit that there's no imminent threat and that they're not seeking arrests. What do you call this if it's not an act of Soviet-style intimidation against dissidents? And I hasten to specify yet again that the dissident groups that are being targeted here represent a political perspective with which I have little sympathy. Some of their professed objectives I find commendable, but then again, for the most part, just about anybody who's involved in politics is quite satisfied that his objectives are laudable and his aims are noble and his motives are pure. So when these people say they want to see an end to America's imperial foreign policy, I say in the name of, in the words of Henry Rollins, hey, I can get behind that. When they talk about the idea of ending narcotics-related wars in Central America and stopping an insane domestic drug war that is putting people in prison by the millions who don't deserve to be there, militarizing law enforcement and degenerating, or perhaps not degenerating, just emerging as a full-blown assault on civil liberties when they object to this and they want to bring it to an end, I say, yes, I can enlist in that effort as well, irrespective of your professed ideology. You seem to have a Jones for Stalin. I don't know why. I don't know why anybody would look upon Stalin as anything other than pretty close to Simon Pure Evil. I don't know why anybody would look at what happened at Tiananmen Square in June of 1989 and say, you know, the good guys were the ones driving the tanks. Now, that's the way the FRSO approached that issue. They managed to contort themselves a la performers out of the Cirque du Soleil in such a way that they could come out supporting the oppressors at Tiananmen Square, even as they profess solidarity with the oppressed. So I don't know what kind of new math style moral calculus they're using to get to where they end up. But they shouldn't be prosecuted as criminals because their minds are cluttered with really bad ideology. If these people are not actively committing aggression against life, liberty, and property, they're not criminals. They're seriously deluded. But the point is that the government that conducted these raids did commit aggression against life, liberty, and property in Minneapolis, in Chicago, in North Carolina, Michigan. Particularly in Minneapolis, when they battered down the door of an apartment using a SWAT team to swarm into that apartment in order to collect the items that are listed in the search and seizure warrant, which I have been reading. I read a little bit at the end of the last segment, and I resume now reading the rest of it. I talked about the first three clauses, which are labeled A, C, and B. I don't know why they left the B out of this, apart from simple ineptitude. Here are the other clauses under the heading of documents, files, books, photographs, videos, souvenirs, war relics, notebooks, address books, diaries, journals, maps, or other evidence, including evidence in electronic form related to the following subjects. Here's subclause, or here's subparagraph E. The recruitment, indoctrination, and facilitation of other individuals in the United States to travel to Colombia, Palestine, and any other foreign location in support of FTOs. I assume that means foreign terrorist organizations, including but not limited to FARC, FARC, that's the narco-terrorist group in Colombia, PFLP, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and Hezbollah, including materials related to the identity and location of recruiters, facilitators, and recruits of these FTOs, the means by which individuals were recruited to travel to Colombia, Palestine, and other foreign locations in support of FTOs, and the means by which the recruitment was financed and arranged. The next clause, FARC, PFLP, Hezbollah, which is misspelled in that clause, and other FTOs to which the FRSO and Kelly have supported, attempted to support, or conspired to support. Support how? Are they accused of raising money? Are they accused of recruiting people who enlist in these groups? They don't specify here. If they had specific evidence of that type of material support, something would reflect that fact in the affidavit. But what they're doing is they're simply giving themselves permission to rifle through everything this man has. Books, files, disks, notebooks. His computers were confiscated. His cell phones were confiscated. His passport was taken from him. He's not been arrested, but he has been subpoenaed. Here's a copy of the subpoena. The grand jury was impaneled in August of last year. He's been subpoenaed to appear later this autumn. You are commanded to bring with you the following documents or objects. For 2001 to the present, all pictures and videos relating to any trip to Colombia, Jordan, Syria, the Palestinian territories, or Israel. All items relating to any trip to Colombia, Jordan, Syria, the Palestinian territories, or Israel. All correspondence, including but not limited to emails and letters with anyone residing in Colombia, Jordan, Syria, the Palestinian territories, or Israel. All records or any payment provided directly or indirectly to Hatem Abudayeh, forgive me, I'm butchering that, Hatem Abudayeh, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, or the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC. 5, all records of any telephonic or electronic communication with anyone in Colombia, Jordan, Syria, the Palestinian territories, or Israel, and any item related to any support provided to any designated terrorist organization, including the PFLP or the FARC. Now, there are a couple of points that have to be made here that are sort of at the meta level, if you will. They don't pertain strictly to this particular case, but they're general points to be made about the nature of our foreign policy and the nature of political pilgrimage. You know, about 20 years ago, there's a fellow by the name of Robert Hollander who wrote a book called Political Pilgrims, and that was a study of people who would go to various exotic locations that were designated the future home of the workers' collectivist paradise. For a long time, of course, the Soviet Union served as the mecca for Marxist pilgrims of that sort. Then, of course, it was communist China. Fidel Castro's Cuba became a popular gathering place for people who belonged to the Venceremos Brigade and outfits of that sort. You'd go cut sugar cane in Cuba. Some people would do that, and then they'd end up migrating to the occupied territories in the Middle East, where they'd don the keffiyeh and perhaps be photographed holding a Kalashnikov or something. There are people who do that, and it's a stupid, stupid thing to do. But they're not limited to the left. There are people who do the same thing on the right. There are all kinds of political tourism-type opportunities for people of various political enthusiasms. There are people with whom I've attended church who have gone to Israel and served as civilian auxiliaries to the Israeli Defense Forces in the occupied territories. They're doing exactly the same thing that people of the left do when they go to the occupied territories and lend aid and support in a material sense to people on the other side of that conflict. Why are we prosecuting the latter, or why the latter subject to this kind of scrutiny that seems to be a prelude to prosecution, but not the former, when they're doing the same thing? They're going across land and sea, making pilgrimages based on their attachments, ideological, sectarian, religious, ethnic, or whatever. It's a bad idea. To the extent that it doesn't actually implicate foreign policy questions covered by the Logan Act, which is to say acting as a supposed representative of the United States government, I don't see where there's a crime involved here. Other than, of course, violations of positivist enactments that are passed by Congress as the result of pressure by various ethnic lobbies. And, of course, there's a huge Israeli lobby. There's a very influential lobby for the Saudi Arabian government. The Cuban the expatriate Cubans in Florida punch well above their weight in political terms. Until about 1978, there was a really big and well-funded lobby for Taiwan. There still is a Taiwan lobby, but it's fallen into eclipse somewhat. These all, of course, represent what George Washington referred to as passionate attachments. And they really have a distorting influence on discussions of foreign policy that result in efforts to criminalize one side or another of distant disputes with which we should not get involved as a matter of principle. That's the other thing that Washington warned about in a speech that was largely ghostwritten by Alexander Hamilton, as it turns out. Alexander Hamilton not being my favorite personality from our founding era. At least he got this right. If somebody feels a calling to go to Israel and to provide sandwiches and drinks for the Israeli Defense Force, that's his right. If he feels a calling to be on the other side of the conflict, that's his right as well. I think they're both wrong. I don't think that you can criminalize one without criminalizing the other. I'd prefer not to criminalize any of it. Just stay out of those messes. We've got trouble enough over here. Thanks for joining me this week. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com for Pro Libertate the blog. I should be updating it either tomorrow morning or tomorrow afternoon. Be aware that there is a PayPal button there if you have the means and inclination. I'd sure appreciate some help. Have a wonderful Lord's Day tomorrow. I'll be back with you in a week. And until then, as always, dum spiro pugno. While I breathe, I fight. Good night. Good luck. God bless.